From the campus of Lenoir Ryan University and the P.E. Monroe Auditorium, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour got sidetracked early on in life. After graduating summa cum laude from Harvard and going to England on a Rhodes Scholarship, he intended to write fiction and published his only work of fiction 4 years later. But when he returned to America, he began tutoring public school children and soon took a job teaching in an inner-city Boston public school in 1964. That detour resulted in his dedicating 4 decades of his life to writing about education and social justice. Jonathan Kozol's first book, Death at an Early Age, The Destruction of the Hearts and Minds of Negro Children in the Boston Public Schools, is a description of that first year he spent as a teacher. It received the 1968 National Book Award and is now regarded as a classic by educators. Indeed, his body of writing is the result of immersing himself in the lives of people who are usually society's most vulnerable members and who suffer at the hands of those more wealthy than they. Rachel and her children, homeless families in America, is an example, as are Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools, and Amazing Grace, The Lives of Children and the Conscience of a Nation, all award winners. Then there's The Shame of the Nation, the restoration of apartheid schooling in America, published in 2005, and which documents the often worsening segregation of America's public schools. In 2007, Jonathan Kozol published another book that deals with resegregation, but Letters to a Young Teacher also speaks of the happiness teaching can bring to teacher and student, as well as addressing our preoccupation with testing over teaching. Through his writing and activism, Jonathan Kozol has given us much to think about, and today, much to discuss. We are delighted to spend this hour with him, so please welcome Jonathan Kozol. For those of you listening on the radio, we're just getting situated in these enormous chairs, which if you sit too far back in, you will disappear into them. Let me tell you. He just told me backstage, and welcome, by the way. Good evening. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be with you.
Just told me backstage that the very first radio you ever did was with the legendary Studs Terkel, who just passed away a few days ago, actually, in Chicago. Talk about that experience for a second. What was that like?
Well, I was scared stiff because I had never dreamed of having a public life. Up till then, I was just a school teacher and a very proud member of that profession. Suddenly, my first book, Death at an Early Age, by some fluke, I still don't know why, won the National Book Award. At that point, my publisher, Houghton Mifflin, decided maybe they'd publicize it a little bit. So they sent me off on a book tour. And since they could see I was terrified, they said, "Don't worry. We're going to send you first to somebody who's going to take good care of you." And that was Studs Terkel. And since then, I must have done a dozen shows with him.
Wow. He was a remarkable man. You mentioned just a second ago that you started teaching and you were a school teacher and you loved that profession, but you wanted to be a fiction writer, and as I just said, you were a Rhodes Scholar, etc. You wrote a novel in Paris, and then you came back to the United States and found yourself tutoring children and later became a teacher in the public schools. Why? Why that detour? Why all this preparation to be a novelist, and then you decide, I'm going to be a public school teacher?
Well, I was like, you know, thousands of young Americans who go to Paris right after college and think they're going to write the great American novel. Instead, they just drink too much wine. But I came back to the States, and it was 1964, and my dad particularly was a prominent doctor in Boston, a neurologist, was really worried about me now because, you know, when I went off as a Rhodes Scholar, I was his golden boy, and now I was 26 and I wasn't doing anything. He thought that by the age of 26, a Rhodes Scholar should at very least be the governor of an insignificant state. And so I was about to go back to Harvard and become a literature professor, which is what I would love to have done. But in the spring of 64, in June of 64, three young people of my age who were volunteers in the civil rights movement, voter registration in Mississippi, disappeared suddenly. And their bodies were found a few weeks later buried beneath a dam in the town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, right, murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. That event just changed my life forever. I got in my little car, naturally. This was the 60s, so it was a VW bug, plastered with happy faces. And I drove over to the black community of Boston, Roxbury. It's like our version of Harlem. And interesting, although I'd grown up in the suburbs, I'd never been in the black community in my life before. And I went to a black minister, a respected figure in the community, and I just said, "May I be of any use at all?" And I'll never forget his answer. He said, "Yes, you can, young man." And in fact, he said, "I'm glad you didn't think you have to go to Mississippi to find racism, because we've got plenty of it right here in our own hometown." And he urged me to become a teacher. That's basically what I did. So I just walked in to the Boston Public Schools and said, "I'm going to be a teacher." Because I'd never heard of certification, of course. And they asked me, "Where did you go to college?" I said, "Harvard." And they said, "Well, then you can't be a teacher, because you couldn't learn anything useful at Harvard." I said, "There must be some way I could do it." And to make a long story short, they said, "Well, sure, you could be a sub." I said, "Why not?"
That's the hardest job in schools.
You said it.
To be a sub.
Oh, the first time I ever taught in my life, they sent me to teach kindergarten. And I had about 40 kids, because just as today, inner city schools were way overcrowded. I didn't know what you do with people that size. You know, to me, they were like gerbils. You know? I just petted them and played with them. But I survived.
Yeah.
And then they gave me a permanent position. I became a fourth grade teacher.
Well, that first book came out in the mid-60s, Death at an Early Age.
That's right.
And it's the chronicling of your experience as a teacher in that first year of your education. And in the last 40 years, you've written scads of other books. And you've been in and out of countless classrooms in inner city situations. Are things today better? Are they worse? Are they the same?
In many ways, I think they're worse. And this is why I say it. At least in those days, although our schools were profoundly segregated and deeply unequal, at least there was the sense that history was on our side because of the leadership in our nation. Dr. King was alive, of course, at the height of his eminence. JFK was president, then Lyndon Johnson. Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, was speaking out boldly on behalf of voter rights. And there was just a sense that history was on our side. What's happened in the past 25 years, as the Supreme Court, the Rehnquist Court, progressively dismantled the great court victory in Brown versus Board of Education, just taking it apart piece by piece, what's happened is that our schools have now reverted to the condition they were in when I began. They are black and Latino children also today are not only given a measurably less equal education in terms of funding and resources, class size, et cetera, salaries of teachers than children in the affluent suburbs, but they are also more segregated in their classrooms right now than at any time since 1968, the year when Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy were taken from us. And at least until Tuesday evening, there was no sense that there were leaders in the nation who might dare to speak out on their behalf.
Yeah. Tuesday evening, of course, was election night when Barack Obama was elected president. And I want to talk about Barack Obama and what you see as what he might bring to this, because education hasn't been talked about a lot in this campaign. And I think you've pointed out in at least one of your books that politicians don't talk much about this, and certainly not in this campaign. Your book, Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, focuses on inner-city children. And a lot of your writing focuses on the schools in Boston and Manhattan, the Bronx, Los Angeles.
Chicago.
So when you talk about the resegregation of American schools, and when you talk about what woeful conditions those children face in terms of how they are educated and how we educate them actively or inactively, is that a blanket statement about all of America? If you walked into the Hickory Public School System here in North Carolina or the Charlotte Public School System, would we face the same kind of situation, or is it just in the major city, inner city schools?
No. I mean, I will concede, being from Massachusetts, I will concede that the most racially integrated schools in the United States are in the South today. The deeply hyper-segregated schools, the major numbers of these schools, are in the large northern cities. In fact, of all the ironies one can imagine, the most segregated state in America for black children in public school is, guess where, New York. Hmm. New York State is now both the most unequal and most segregated state in the nation. Michigan is second, I suppose, because of Detroit, and Illinois third because of Chicago and other smaller cities. But it's not just big cities. I mean, just recently I went across Pennsylvania and I spoke in some middle-sized cities, former industrial cities like Allentown in Erie, Pennsylvania. And there, too, I'll walk into schools, perhaps into a high school that has as many as 2,000 students, and I might see five white kids the whole day. Everyone else is either black, Latino, or a recent immigrant from Southeast Asia, perhaps, something like that. So, you know, if you grew up when I did, with that tremendous rush of hope that we felt, first when Brown was passed down by the Warren Court, and then when Dr. King's oratory and his courage stirred the soul of the nation. If you grew up in that era, and now you're with me, and you would walk into one of these schools, your heart would sink. I mean, I just look around me at the children in the classroom, and if I dare, I look into their eyes. And I always see they're looking into my eyes, too, because especially little kids search grown-ups all the time. And I just try to tell myself that it's for this post-modern and millennial
apartheid. Hold that thought. We have to stop.
That all those people
die. Our guest.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by Catawba College in Salisbury, where students gain an education rich in personal attention, blending the liberal arts with career preparation. Details, catawba.edu. And by Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, introducing the redesigned 2009 Acura TSX and TL sedans, featuring standard Bluetooth, wireless telephone, and MP3 integration. Virtual showroom at hendrickacura.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, it's a Veterans Day program. We look back at Charlotte's history with American wars from the moment British General Cornwallis described our region as a hornet's nest of resistance during the Revolution. Charlatans have put down pitchforks, plows, and their briefcases and have taken up arms to defend American interests. We'll take a look at our veterans' commitments and sacrifices tomorrow morning at 9 here on 90.7 FM WFAE. We'll get back to our conversation with Jonathan Kozel on Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
Barack Obama meets with his economic advisors as the Treasury Department proposes additional measures to address the financial crisis, steps by the president-elect to reassure anxious Americans about the state of the economy. The Diane Rehm Show, Monday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting today from Lenoir Rhine University. And our guest is Jonathan Kozel, the author of many, many books on education in this country, the latest of which is Letters to a Young Teacher. And we had to take a break in the middle of a thought a moment ago. And you were talking about how children, people who grew up in the 60s and who went through the Civil Rights Movement, if they walked into a public school after a 40-year absence today, you were saying that your heart would sink because you'd be seeing what you saw 40 years ago.
Yes, it's sort of about, there I am in these allegedly liberal cities of the North, like New York, and the scenario in the classroom is racially is identical with what you see in those old faded photographs of Mississippi from the 1950s. And I might point out one thing, since you mentioned President-elect Obama. Naturally, given my background, I rejoice in the outcome of the election. But it's important to note that he didn't go to one of these types of schools, nor did any of the other really distinguished black figures in American cultural life, Colin Powell, for example. Mm-hmm. So when the nation says, well, we've solved the problem now, it's not really so. It's true there's been a breathtaking breakthrough at the upper levels of society, but I never forget all those millions who have been left behind.
Well, you've said, you told another interviewer, that most Americans are unaware of just how badly segregated these schools have become. And you say, as you just said, that if you took a photograph, it would just look like Mississippi in the 1950s. But there are those who would say to you that in the 1950s, our schools were segregated because of the color of a person's skin, and that today, if they are segregated, they are segregated because of economics.
There is this significant difference that they were then segregated by law also, and today it's only de facto segregation. But I would not accept the general placebo that you hear from politicians that it's only economic. I think it's more than that, because what we see in New York, for example, is thousands of poor people coming there as immigrants, mm-hmm. but all the immigrants of color somehow are herded into the neighborhoods and attend the schools that black and Latino kids go to, while all these Eastern European immigrants end up going to the same kind of schools that I would have attended. So there's And they're all poor at first. So I don't think it's purely economic. But the thing is, you're right to the degree that race and economics are tightly intertwined. It doesn't matter too much to the kids that I know up in the South Bronx, which is the most segregated part of New York City. It just doesn't matter much whether they're cut off and concealed and sequestered in this way. Because they're poor, because they're black, are isolated totally.
Tell me how, describe a classroom, describe a school experience of these children, and tell me how it would differ from a suburban white experience.
Just a few simple examples. Typically, when I walk into these schools, I find myself in elementary classrooms with as many as 32, 34 children, in some cases as many as 40 children in a fourth grade in the start of the year. Maybe if they're lucky later in the year, they'll split the class up, but that's very common. I go to not the richest suburb, just a good suburban school, and parents begin to be worried if class size tips above 22, and they really would like it to be 18. I go into the high schools, and I find the kids are lucky if they have four AP classes, advanced placement classes. Then I go out to a good suburban high school and I'll find 15 AP courses in, you know, everything from English literature to advanced physics to Mandarin Chinese, whatever. One other difference is the turnover of teachers. There are incredible numbers of absolutely heroic, marvelous young teachers going into the inner city schools. There's no question. There's a flood of absolutely idealistic, morally enlightened young people of all races, but inevitably in elementary school they're mostly white females. And they're steeped in civil rights history from college, and they adore the kids, and they connect with them well. But the conditions are so discouraging. The class size so large, salaries relatively so low compared to the rich suburbs, and nowadays the anxiety connected with testing and test prep. Some of these schools are like testing factories nowadays. Mm-hmm. Is so great that half of all young teachers quit the urban schools within 2 years. And that turnover, the instability of faculty, is terrible for kids. It just, you know, one little girl who's in every one of my last three books because she insisted on it.
Is this Pineapple?
Pineapple, uh-huh. Yes. This bossy little girl. She got so mad when I didn't put her picture on the cover of my first two books that I gave in and put her on the third book just so she wouldn't keep driving me crazy. She had 70 different teachers in fourth and fifth grades.
70?
Seven. But, you know, these weren't just like one-day subs. I mean, she'd have one teacher for 3 months, and then another one for 6 months maybe, another one for 2 weeks, and it just drives what
and
happens.
And you write.
Then the children behave impossibly.
Yes.
And then a stranger who comes in who has no sympathy for the kids says, these kids behave like animals.
And you write, well, you write in your book that this leads to something that perhaps adults don't think about, and that is a lack of trust. Oh, this person's not going to be here very long. There's no rapport. They're afraid to set up a rapport because he or she is going to disappear.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I admired so much the young teacher I wrote about most recently in my newest book, Letters
Francesca.
To the Young Teacher, because she recognized that challenge. She was a very well-educated, marvelously exciting person, just a glorious human being, a white woman. And she walks into an all-black school, and there were some little kids in that class who really didn't want to trust her at first, even though they were only first graders. They already had this uneasiness. Why should we trust her? She's from that world out there. And the reason I wrote this book is to give teachers an example of how if you do it with great skill and you bring your whole heart and soul to bear, you can overcome that problem. She won them over, and they came not only to trust her, but to love her. In fact, it was such a beautiful year for those children that the principal let her go on and teach them in first grade, and she went with them to second grade also. And they call that looping. That's a new term in education. Yeah. And the parents, and she, by the way, thumbed her nose at the federal testing law. She was very well educated. She knew that testing, test anxiety is not a good substitute for thirst and exhilaration about learning. And she refused to do any drilling for exams. She refused to use this horrible, boring Basel Reader. The Basel Reader is like this pit-pat phonics book that NCL Washington recommended, No Child Left Behind recommended. She refused to use it. She just flooded the room with hundreds of the most exciting, beautiful children's classics you can imagine, including lots of multiracial stuff, all the books that children everywhere treasure. And her kids, it turned out, did well on their exams.
How did she get away with doing it, though? How did she?
She was lucky. First of all, she had a principal who also thought this law was an abomination. And the principal couldn't say that openly. No superintendent will say that, though a lot of them believe it just as I do. Her principal couldn't say that in public, but her principal just loved Francesca's sort of mischievous irreverence. And the other thing is, Francesca was very clever. When the people from the state came around, they come around to check on you under No Child Left Behind. Teachers call them the curriculum cops. They come around to see if at 9:22 in the morning you're teaching skill number 65, you know. And she might have done that at 8:10. And at 9:45, they might just be reading beautiful poetry. And but she was clever. If they said to her, what proficiency are you teaching now? See, by the way, Mike, you can't say skill anymore.
Jargon. It's all full of jargon.
You have to use polysyllables for everything. Right. You can't just encourage something. You have to facilitate it. You know, you can't copy a good idea. You have to replicate it. So proficiency.
You have a whole list in the book of these jargon.
I do. Phrases. I call it, it's to teachers, I say, beware the jargon factory, because it'll just drive you crazy and you'll end up talking like an abnormal person. I mean, nobody would go out in the street and say, could you replicate that hot dog for me? You know, so anyway, she was lucky. Her principal backed her up. But here's the ultimate point. And I always say this to young teachers. If you're going to be a bit irreverent about this governmental bamboozlement, this nonsense, this testing craze, if you're going to be irreverent about it, you better be good at what you do. And you better work awful hard. And she worked harder than most teachers I've known would ever work, since she was teaching them to read out of real books. She had to read all those books. She just gave up reading grown-up literature for a year. It wasn't painful, because there are a lot of marvelous children's books. You know.
I want to talk about No Child Left Behind at some length in a moment or two, but before we do that, in this book, Letters to a Young Teacher, you say that inner-city schools don't simply make a mockery of Brown versus Board of Education. They don't even live up to Plessy versus Ferguson, which stipulated back in 1896 that if schools were to be separate, then at the very least, they had to be equal. So you're saying that they're not equal. You also alluded, I believe, a little while ago, that the whittling away of all this at the Supreme Court level. Is this just a matter of them taking a stand on little pieces of law, or is this a deliberate agenda that's being waged both by the judiciary and by the Bush administration through No Child Left Behind at doing something to undercut the effectiveness of the public school system, in your mind?
Yes, it's the latter, in my belief. I don't believe in meticulous conspiracies, just simple ones. But in other words, I'm quite certain that members of the majority of the Supreme Court never met with the Attorney General and said, you know, let's see how unjust we can make American education. That's what they've ended up with, however. The court took apart Brown on the crazy basis that anything which encourages integration of black and white children, for example, there are a lot of voluntary programs in America where inner city black parents and Latino parents are allowed to send their children to a nearby but very good suburban school. Voluntary, no force involved. These are just enlightened, good-hearted suburbs which believe it's good for their kids also. Okay? Mm-hmm. The court recently decided that even that is unconstitutional, because that favors black children. They call it reverse discrimination. I never thought we'd come to that point of saying that having a program of integration that's absolutely voluntary for the kids, for the parents, for the local districts, is being too nice to black folks. But on the part of the administration, the Bush administration, I believe deep in my heart that the purpose of No Child Left Behind was never to close the achievement gap between the races or to improve the overall quality of public schools. I believe it was intended as a shaming ritual, as a method of humiliation of the entire public sector in education in America, in order to soften up the ground
to demonstrate that they were ineffective educators?
To essentially set up impossible demands without providing the funds to meet those demands, and then using the consequent failure to say, well, then I guess we ought to look at private vouchers. I think that's it. In any case, whatever their intent, the law did not work. It was not successful. They did not close the achievement gap. In spite of a few upticks in fourth grade scores for black and Latino kids, these are only testing gains, which are easy to get if you just drill children for tests. They're not learning gains because they don't sustain themselves. If they were learning gains, you would see them carry on in middle school and high school, but you don't. In fact, the high school dropout rate for children of minorities now is just as high as it was before the law was passed, and many people think it's getting higher because so many of these kids are just dropping out of sheer desperation.
Yeah, and that's also why teachers leave, isn't it?
Because
of the pressure on them to perform or to get results that may not be gettable, obtainable.
Just one quick stat on dropouts. Just take two cities, two of the largest school systems in America, Chicago and New York. Those two cities, in those two cities, which together educate 10% of all the black men in America, only 30% of black boys entering ninth grade ever get to 12th grade and graduate.
Say that again?
Only 30% of the entering ninth graders complete 4 years of school and graduate from 12th grade. That's the national average isn't quite as bad. It's about 50%. Think of the loss, not just to those kids, but to American society.
Well, I have 30 seconds, and we can come back and follow up on this. But is that, do you think, because of a deliberate attempt to discriminate against African Americans or against poor people or other people not like ourselves, or is it simply a misguided philosophy of education?
The latter. I think I don't impute such demonic motives to anybody. Well, a few, but not too many of them in Washington. I think that this came from the delusion that creating high anxiety, fear of exams, sort of establishing a rigidity, a kind of proto-military rigidity, was a good substitute for the kind of exciting learning privileged children are used to in America.
Jonathan Kozel is our guest here at Lenoir Ryan University. We will continue in just a moment.
More conversation in just a moment on 90.7 FM WFAE. Our programming funded by Mariner, giving people access to information to make better decisions and improve the bottom line with enterprise reporting solutions, balanced scorecards, and performance management dashboards. Mariner-USA.com. And by Master Builder Fellowship for the Built Environment, a residential and commercial design build group using energy-efficient techniques for more than a decade to harmonize with the environment. On the web at MasterBuilderFellowship.com. Coming up next at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, President-elect Obama and the economic crisis. A look at possible steps by the president-elect to reassure anxious Americans about the state of the economy. That's next in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. You can hear an after-show bonus segment of today's Charlotte Talks guest Jonathan Kozel from our conversation at Lenoir Ryan College last week, where he talks about his friend Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers. You can hear this web extra from today's show. Just go to WFAE.org and click on Charlotte Blogs. When you lose your keys, you're locked out. You can't get to what's essential. Many of you have told us that WFAE is the key to the kind of in-depth political, financial, and cultural coverage you rely on. Morning Edition helps set the breakfast table with just the right blend of information. And Charlotte never quite comes together the way it does when Mike Collins guides the conversation on Charlotte Talks. Your financial support of 90.7 FM WFAE is the key to the programming you depend on. Thanks.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're at Lenore Ryan University at P.E. Monroe Auditorium with Jonathan Kosel and about 800 of his closest personal friends in Hickory. Now, just prior to the break, I asked you about intent.
Yes.
Was it intentional, this resegregation and this the horrible conditions that they're placing in these public schools, according to you? And you said, no, it wasn't. It was just bad policy. But you also write about how schools have become, I think, factories to produce workers as opposed to produce literate, educated people. Is that part of a grand design, or is that simply what we have to do to be competitive in the world today?
No, I'm not quite that paranoid.
Okay.
Although Freud did tell us that sometimes the paranoids are right. They are against you. But I don't think so. I think, frankly, what I think is at stake here at the largest level is that there's a lot of people, there has been, a large number of people who have been in power for quite a while in Washington, who somehow in their hearts simply believe that Plessy versus Ferguson was right, that you can have good, happy, equal, successful, segregated schools, and who believe that that's a legitimate and plausible way to educate a nation. They probably, in order to sweeten the pill, they probably, you know, will say, well, yes, they should have a little more money or more computers or, you know, we'll give them some bright young volunteers from a group like Teach for America, which, of course, doesn't cost the government anything, so it's a cheap way out. But essentially, they're saying we'll polish the apple of apartheid and then it will be tasty. And they're just wrong. History has proven them wrong. Separate was never equal in the century just past. It never will be in the century ahead. I believe the Warren Court was right. What they're trying to do is, you know, have high-scoring, highly regimented, test-aligned, mercilessly tension-ridden, happy, segregated schools. And it just ain't going to happen. It ain't going to work. And the ultimate reason, Mike, is not that separate almost always means financially unequal in resources. There's a deeper reason. It's the following. Kids learn as much from each other as they learn from any textbook or any teacher. You learn by osmosis from what the other guys and girls in your little third grade bring in to the classroom with them. And the little ones I know in places like Chicago, South Central Los Angeles, and now increasingly southern cities like Greensboro and Charlotte, which are returning to segregation, I've been told, what you're seeing are minority kids who simply aren't aware of all the options that are out there in this beautiful, good, basically good, rich country of ours, because they never heard about them, because their parents have the same separate and unequal education, so their parents aren't savvy about these options. I know kids in Harlem, in New York, who do not know that there's a major university called Columbia, 12 blocks from their home. The only college they've ever heard of is the local community college, which is 100% minority. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
They've never heard of Cornell, which is just a few hours north of the city. They certainly never heard of great southern colleges and small liberal arts colleges like this one. Whereas, it's not only that you get shortchanged financially and you have larger class size and less, you know, and less continuity of experienced teachers. The worst is that you don't know how to navigate the larger society. And if by luck you make it to college, as some do, then it's a real psychological hurdle to figure out how to adapt to a world you never knew.
So are you saying that's what comes of segregation? In other words, if these schools were as integrated as they were, say, in the, what, 70s?
Yes, in the late 70s was the high point.
That they would be exposed to these ideas, exposed to these realities outside of their own environment, and would learn to navigate the world?
Yes, and indeed, that's what's happening today in all these voluntary integration programs that I mentioned. Almost every northern city has one or two of these programs. They're now endangered by the recent Supreme Court ruling. But in my hometown of Boston, for example, black and Latino kids are free if they want, if their parents want, to ride a relatively short distance, not a horrendous drive, short distance to one of 20 of the top suburbs in America. And by the way, there's a waiting list of 16,000 children to get into that program. That's a third of all the black kids in Boston. So people often say, do black folks really care about that anymore? I say, yeah, if you give them the chance to go to the kind of schools you and I went to. I'm saying you and I as if I'm talking to a white person. And by the way, of those black kids who go to these suburban schools, they pick up so much from the other kids. They learn mutually from each other,
yeah,
both ways. But the black kids have a 90% college entrance record, and 95% of them graduate from high school. Compare that to any city in America.
Let's take a question from the audience. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. I was wondering what a sort of utopian vision of an American education system would look like in your mind, and perhaps what someone like Barack Obama or anybody involved, teachers, parents, principals, can and students themselves can help do to get it that way?
Excellent question. I'll give two answers. One of them, I don't think the president-elect would dare to touch. The other one, I think he will. The best thing we could do to end the gross inequality of schooling, which, by the way, takes a high toll on poor white rural kids, too, because their property base is low. The heart of this injustice is that we are still stuck with funding public education in America by an undemocratic, archaic reliance on local property wealth. That's the curse. Because what that means is if your daddy and mom can afford to buy a $1 million home in a beautiful verdant suburb, you're going to get a $1 million education. So in other words, the quality of your education, the money that goes into it, depends entirely on the accident of birth. We got to get rid of that. And here's how I would do it. I don't care if we keep the property tax or not, but if we keep it, we ought to use it as part of it ought to go into a common pool that serves the education of all children, not simply the children in that community.
Isn't that spreading the wealth?
Yes, it is. My liberal friends in New York, but it's more accurate to call them former liberal friends. They invite me to dinner parties and they're very nervous with me because I don't know why they invite me, because they're afraid I'm going to ruin the dinner, you know, because they secretly think I want to redistribute their wealth. And I do. But the way to make this a fair system is the following. No matter how we raise money, whether it's from income tax, sales tax, property tax, taxes on gambling, whatever, however it's done, it all ought to go into a national pool. And then it should be assigned to every single child in this nation on an equitable basis, adjusted only for differences in cost of living in different sections of the nation and the greater or lesser needs of certain kids. That is an idea the president-elect will not touch because it's so drastic. But frankly, I'll just say in one sentence, it makes sense because nobody goes to school in order to learn to be a citizen of Charlotte or Boston or Milwaukee. We don't say Pledge of Allegiance to the state of Arizona. certainly not Arizona. And, you know, we say a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States. And if we serve in the military, we're not going to die under the flag of New Hampshire. It will be the Stars and Stripes. So, you know, what we have today is an unequal social contract. And someday that's going to be changed.
So what do you think he will do?
What'd you say?
What do you think he will do?
What he will do is this. As I've seen, I've been meeting with his chief of staff in Washington. He's determined to make one big change, and that is in the readiness of children for public school. One of the great inequalities right now is that in the poorest neighborhoods, I'll go into a kindergarten, I'll find that 3/4 of the kids had no pre-K at all, preschool. Mm-hmm. Or if they did, it was token, you know, it was like grandma care, child care. It wasn't the real thing. And the wealthy people typically put their kids into these marvelous preschools when they're 2.5. And they're expensive, too. They'll spend $20,000 a year in New York for these. He's proposed a massive increase in preschool education. I think the number I saw was $20 billion, which is more than double what the nation now spends on preschool. I argued for $40 billion. I told one of his assistants I thought $40 billion was better because then you could give it to all these kids starting when they're 2.5 years old. He said, I don't think this Congress would ever spend $40 billion for anything. But that was a few months ago. Now it seems like you could just slip it in as a hiccup.
Because we're spending all this money.
$700 billion and $40, you know. What's the difference?
Did that answer your question? As long as we're talking, and we only have a few minutes left, but as long as we're talking about No Child Left Behind and expenditures per pupil and funding, et cetera, you have an argument that you tell your rich friends, I suppose at these dinner parties, when they start talking about vouchers for education, people will say to you and to others, people have said it to me on this program, that the answer to our educational problems is not throwing more money at the problem. And you say that's what vouchers do, essentially, right?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I'm all in favor of more money if it goes to the public system. You know, when they say, can you really solve this kind of problem by throwing money at it? I always say, sure, throw it. Drop it from a helicopter. I'll take it there myself. I don't know a better way to pay a great young teacher enough to stay there, not just for a couple of years while she's still high on one of my books, but for a lifetime. But the vouchers are poison, and it's very simple in my mind. Leaving out all the other problems. When people think of vouchers, they usually think, well, vouchers would just go to nice, familiar institutions that don't worry us, like a good local Catholic church runs its own school, or Lutheran school, or something like that. Or if you're a woodsy Walden product of the counterculture, maybe a Montessori school. You know what I mean? But the trouble is, if you can give vouchers to Catholic schools or Lutheran schools, you can't constitutionally deny them to any other kind of sectarian schools or schools with any other kind of ideological edge. So there you go. You'll have Pat Robertson schools. You'll have David Dukes-type schools. You'll have every sectarian group in the country, ideological or religious, will claim a right to public money to indoctrinate children according to their own ideals. But that would rip apart the social fabric of America.
But you also say to people who say, well, more money for public schools isn't going to make things better, and they have their children in private schools when they say this,
that's right.
It's working for you.
Oh, yeah. I have friends who have two kids at Andover, which is near where I live in Massachusetts, probably one of the three most exclusive prep schools in America. They're spending $40,000 for each child to go to Andover. And they look at me and they say, can you really buy your way to better education for poor children? I always say, I don't know. Seems to work for your kids.
You told me before you started, that we started this conversation earlier backstage, that Senator Ted Kennedy had sought your counsel and advice on No Child Left Behind and told you prior to the election that because this bill is up for reauthorization, that it was a dead issue. It's not coming back. But I have a question in light of that.
Okay.
If we de-emphasize testing and teaching for the test, how do we assure that there's accountability in the system?
I don't know any teacher who's afraid to be held accountable. See, good, and if they are, they shouldn't be teaching. I think good teachers are every bit as much in favor of high standards, for example, as is the outgoing president. We want to be held accountable, but we need to be held accountable for the right things. Here's the main thing. We need accountability, but it's got to be two-way accountability. If we're going to hold a little girl 8 years old in third grade accountable for her performance on a standardized exam, then I think we have the right to hold our Congress and our president, whoever it is, accountable for giving that little girl the same opportunities that his own children probably received. And that's it. And I'm in favor of mutual accountability.
Our guest, Jonathan Kozel, author of many, many books, including Letters to a Young Teacher. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.